Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I am happy to be speaking to Connie Chang. Connie is the Director of Environmental Studies and Professor of History and Environmental Studies at Bowdoin College. She's the author of Shaping the Shoreline, Fisheries and Tourism on the Monterey Coast, that was published by the University of Washington Press in 2008. And we're here today to discuss her recent book, Nature Behind Barbed Wire, an environmental history of the Japanese American incarceration, that was published by Oxford University Press in 2018. Connie, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric.
Would you start just by describing your book to our listeners?
Yeah, so the book explores the forced relocation and detention of over 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry during World War II from an environmental perspective. So really looking at how both the land and waters of the Pacific coast from where the Japanese came from, as well as the physical environments of the camps themselves, how that shaped their experiences, but also the experiences of the federal officials who administered the camp. So I'm really looking at their interactions with each other, but also looking at the Japanese American incarceration as an environmental process. So how did the actual wartime program interact with, interface with the physical environment in which these camps were located?
In your book title, you call it Environmental History of Japanese American Incarceration. And of course, under, in kind of the general public, it calls it internment. And I don't like that term internment myself, I think it's kind of a cop-out about what really happened. And you use the term incarceration. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about how you came to what you think is the right terminology for this.
Right. The terminology is a subject of quite a bit of debate and has been for some time now among scholars of and others interested in the Japanese American experience during World War II. Internment, as you noted, is probably the more commonly known or used term. But technically, internment refers to the treatment of individuals from who are citizens of an enemy nation during wartime. And because 2/3 roughly of the individuals affected by the American program during World War II were actually American citizens, they were second generation Nisei, as the Japanese term, which refers to the Japanese term for second generation, internment therefore is not an apt word. Only 1/3 of the individuals affected were actually technically interned because they were citizens of Japan. Even then, that's problematic because they were not allowed to become citizens, and many of them probably would have become naturalized citizens if that option had been available to them. So there are a variety of reasons why internment is not a particularly accurate term. So I use incarceration. Incarceration is problematic for ways that I describe at the very beginning of my book. That said, I think it more accurately reflects the experiences of Japanese Americans during the war, that they were forcibly removed from their homes, that they were placed in camps where they could not leave, come and go as they pleased. There were armed guards, there were barbed wire fences. I mean, they were not in, cells, prison cells per se, but that being said, their freedoms were very much restricted during the war. So hence the use of the term incarceration instead of internment. Really just, I think it's an important statement of just acknowledging that the majority of those affected weren't citizens of Japan and were American citizens and were experiencing a massive violation of their civil liberties.
Okay. This is a story that in its broad outlines has been pretty well accepted by the American public. There's a lot of regret over these things and claims at least that this won't happen again, although with, what's happening with immigration today, that one could certainly, one could certainly push back on that, those kind of easy claims. But in the story that is commonly told, I mean, I think there might be a sense that these camps are pretty isolated areas, there's not really a sort of popular environmental idea, I think, or environmental history of the camp. So, I guess, what does thinking about the environment specifically, and that physical experience of the people in the camps. What does that add to this overall narrative that our readers and listeners would know already?
Yeah, that's a great question, and certainly central to why I even embarked on this project to begin with. I mean, I think most environmental historians have some adherence to this idea that every story, but many stories have an environmental angle or perspective that's important. And I think incarceration is one of those. So what I'm trying to get at with this book and why the environment matters is that, yes, indeed, there is this common narrative of this you know, atrocious, egregious violation of civil liberties. But what I wanted to get at is that, yes, that I don't dispute that point, but I really want to show the ways in which the environment amplified that experience of civil liberties violation. But another part of the sort of general scholarship of incarceration is one of resistance and resilience of Japanese Americans. And I think looking at the ways that they engaged with the physical environment also adds to that story as well, that this wasn't just a story of Japanese American oppression at the hands of the federal government, but it was very much one where the physical environment certainly amplified that feeling, those feelings of oppression, but also provided opportunities for Japanese Americans to resist and push back and really develop the terms of their own incarceration in small, but I think significant ways. So that's one way I think the environment complicates things. And lastly, I'll say that I also really wanted to complicate this sort of binary of the federal government as being oppressive and the Japanese American being the oppressed, the oppressor versus oppressed. I think that the environmental perspective suggests that federal officials very much had complicated perspectives. There wasn't sort of a monolithic sort of agenda per se. And moreover, the environmental complexities and vagaries of these various sites also very much complicated their efforts to administer the camps. So I think bringing an environmental perspective sort of complicates and adds nuance to the federal government's kind of position as well. And so on both ends, both in looking at Japanese Americans as well as the War Relocation Authority officials, I think an environmental perspective shows that it wasn't black and white. It never was black and white to begin with. And there was a lot of negotiation happening on both ends, with the environment sort of being in the midst of these negotiations.
Yeah, I want to touch on quite a bit of what you were just talking about. And I think one of the things to start with is, and one of the things I think that I really enjoyed about the book is that it really explores how, you know, people from one particular part of the West Coast were being sent to one particular camp, and that there's, you know, it's not a random sort of thing. And so the environmental transformation is different between the different camps. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could talk a little bit about that kind of, you know, the kind of environmental life that people were living in Washington, Oregon, California, and how that gets sort of that sort of sudden shock of transformation as they go to, you know, to Idaho or to, you know, Eastern Cal, you know, to the deserts of California or Arizona or wherever.
Yeah, so I think that there's definitely regional variation. The both in terms of the home residences of Japanese Americans, as well as where specifically they were incarcerated during the war. I don't cover all 10 of the camps, so there's certain gaps to my response, but I do look at the Pacific Northwest folks, those individuals, mostly Seattle, Portland, some of the outlying areas. They were incarcerated at Minidoka in Seattle, so, or Minidoka in Idaho. the most of the folks from the San Francisco Bay Area were at Topaz in Utah, and most Southern Californians went to Manzanar, and then the other camp I look at is Gila River in Arizona, which had mostly Southern Californians, a lot of farmers, more people with more rural agricultural backgrounds. So I think you can see that somewhat reflected in the camps themselves. So Gila River had a very very strong farming program. I think definitely drew on the expertise of the Japanese Americans who went to that particular camp. Manzanar had many gardeners and nurserymen from the greater Los Angeles area, and Manzanar had some of the more elaborate gardens among the camps. Certainly, all of the camps had beautiful, extensive gardens throughout. Both small and large, but I would say that Manzanar had some of the more impressive examples of gardening, and I think that is somewhat a reflection of the pre-war population and their particular areas of expertise. Topaz, because it was because of its soil conditions, didn't have the best agricultural program, and probably not. So that's part of the problem, and also most of the population at Topaz did not have farming backgrounds. So you see kind of fewer opportunities for them to sort of embrace kind of agricultural endeavors and didn't have as much pre-existing expertise in that regard. So yeah, there are definitely ways in which the particular places from which they came very much affected the kinds of activities they pursued in the camps, but it also very much reflected the conditions in the camps themselves. So Gila River had a good farming program because of the Japanese who were there, but also because it had a very long growing season, and most of the other camps had very short growing seasons. So,
yeah. The only one of the four camps that you discussed that I've been to is Minidoka. And, you know, when I went out there, it's not as isolated as some, I suppose, in that that may be more true today just because of the expansion of Idaho, you know, along the expansion of Idaho's population along the Snake River and that area. But, you know, it just felt to me being out there and kind of growing up in the Pacific Northwest and on the west side of the Cascades, that kind of just desolation and isolation that people must have felt as they are forced into these places with, you know, poorly prepared housing and, you know, not really ready to have large numbers of people living there. Just must have been a shock beyond anything I could possibly imagine, and a shock that only exacerbated the already existing horror of being forced out of your home and forced into a camp and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even those who were from smaller outlying areas, I think regardless, it was a shock, and part of it was because they weren't used to aridity. That was a big issue for most of the folks from the Pacific Coast. Not all of them. Some of them were living in the San Joaquin Valley, very dry, fairly sparsely populated areas. But most of them were coming from places like Seattle or San Francisco or Berkeley or Los Angeles and other more temperate places, and also more urban places with you know, lots of sort of ethnic businesses and restaurants and that sort of thing. So to go from these pretty vibrant communities, whether urban or rural, to these very desolate, isolated places that had very different weather, I think that was very bewildering. And I think that's very much reflected in the numerous oral histories and memoirs that I drew upon. And most of these oral histories and memoirs don't focus on the environment. And yet, invariably, the person will talk about what they felt like or what their reactions when they first arrived. And they will almost always talk about the heat. They will almost talk about how cold the winters were. They'll often talk about depending on the camps, but many of the camps had dust storms, and they'll talk about these dust storms and how, you know, dust got everywhere and was just like impossible to keep their barracks clean. So they were very much reacting to a distinct physical environment that they had previously not experienced.
And how then did they adjust to create the best they could a livable environment in these very difficult conditions?
So a lot of small and big ways, right? So I think, you know, the farming programs were certainly quite impressive, but that was very much WRA initiated and in some ways kind of forced upon them. All of the camps had farm programs. So the other ways in which that were more sort of Japanese American sort of initiated would be moments of outdoor recreation. So many Japanese Americans pursued gardening, I already mentioned, but also hiking and fishing and sort of engaging with the environment around them. And they kind of became appreciative of the landscape around them in ways that, you know, I think were probably unexpected given how unfamiliar they were. There were other ways in which we see they're kind of making the best of things that I don't talk about in the book specifically, but, you know, ways in which they made modifications to their barracks to deal with the heat, to deal with the cold during the winter. I think there are a wide range of ways in which Japanese Americans tried to adapt to, but also alter their physical surroundings to make it more inhabitable.
And you know, one of the big themes of your book are these agricultural programs. And so, and the ways in which people are forced into them with various backgrounds and things like that. Could you talk a little bit more about these agricultural programs and how they shape life in the incarceration camps?
Yeah. So the WRA, the War Relocation Authority, very much wanted the camps to be somewhat self-supporting. They certainly weren't. But, you know, the idea that there were these camps that were draining federal money during a time of wartime was a possible public relations problem. So the WRA recognized that and realized that having Japanese Americans grow their own food would be prudent and possibly cost-saving as well. Moreover, many of the Japanese Americans had extensive agricultural expertise, and so it was a way to draw upon their skills as well. So all of the camps had farm programs, again, some much more successful than others, and certainly the idea was that surpluses could be sent in between camps. So Tule Lake and Gila River produced the most produce, and any excess could be shipped to camps with less verdant agricultural programs. So that's sort of in a nutshell how they operated, but in terms of on the ground, I think there were certainly many people with existing farming expertise who appreciated having the opportunity to, or maybe appreciate's the wrong word, but they were willing to use their expertise in order to help grow food. And in some cases, this is a moment of negotiation where Japanese American farmers would say, we don't want to grow this particular variety of food that you're telling us to grow because we don't eat it. So we'd rather grow something else, maybe other foods that were more specific to Japanese American foodways. So daikon radishes, for instance, and other kinds of fresh greens that were more common to a Japanese American diet were sort of enveloped into the farm program. So I think that's one example where we see Japanese Americans negotiating with federal officials and federal officials accepting that they want them to grow food that they'll actually eat and not food that's going to go to waste. So there's a little bit of that. There's certainly pushback within the agricultural program. Some individuals who don't want to work on the farms and would rather do something else, or, you know, don't want to labor in the heat under these very difficult circumstances. So we also see moments of resistance as well in the camps when it came to agriculture. And then obviously real need for adaptation. Japanese Americans with farming expertise were going to areas where from areas where irrigation was not as widely used. So if you're a farmer in the Pacific Northwest, irrigation wouldn't have been a really big issue, if at all. And then they were going to arid places like Minidoka and Idaho that if you had to have irrigation in order to grow anything. And so they had to learn how to farm in a dramatically different way than they were accustomed to. So even their prior expertise proved to be not necessarily as useful as perhaps the federal government had anticipated because they were farming under such different conditions. So another example where the federal government had was sort of had to adapt and realize, wow, we have all these really skilled Japanese American farmers, but they don't really know how to irrigate. And so we have to teach them how to irrigate and properly so they don't overwater their crops, for instance.
One thing that, you know, you mentioned the daikon radishes, and I really enjoyed that piece of the book because, you know, it felt like food as a place of negotiation, even in this very difficult time. You know, obviously in the pre-war communities, Japanese Americans had developed their own food networks and their own stores and their own very particular products that obviously were not really common in your general food ways of the rest of the United States in 1940. And so could you talk a little bit more about how food serves as a spot of negotiation or resistance or adaptation by the people forced into these camps?
Yeah, I mean, I don't go into great detail about food. There are other scholars who talk more about food and food ways in the context of incarceration. But I think it certainly is one arena where you can see, or one sort of aspect of incarceration where you can see Japanese Americans sort of developing their own, or at least being able to push back against the federal government and sort of assert their desire to maintain their own food ways. So what they grew was certainly a part of that. So for sure, being able to adopt the seed schedule and even provide seed. So there were definitely Japanese Americans who were providing seed for other camps. So if they had extra, you know, if they had the radish seeds, for instance, or the particular green seeds, they would be able to provide those to the other camps. So it wasn't just one particular camp that was able to produce something. Those seeds could be shared among the different camps. Some of the camps also had like tofu factories, shoyu factories. I don't write about those, but they definitely existed. So another example in which Japanese Americans were able to produce foods that were particular to their diet and their food ways. And again, the federal government was largely supportive of those endeavors, again, recognizing the importance of making sure that the food produced was eaten and consumed and maintaining the health of Japanese Americans, at least when it came to their diet, and also, frankly, reducing the amount of rations they use. So Japanese Americans were subject to the same rations as other homefront Americans, and obviously the more food that they grew, the fewer ration points they use. So it was advantageous to support these endeavors. And I should say they also were also raising livestock, although the success of livestock raising was mixed at most of the camps, but they were certainly also raising meat and eggs and dairy cows as well.
And one of the themes of your book is how, you know, the people use this new world in which they're forced into as part of a resistance strategy. And how does environment and resistance come together in your project?
So I think there are a few ways. I mean, one really prominent way was through labor resistance. So I do have a chapter in the book that talks about two moments of labor resistance. One of them had to do at Topaz, where there was a need to replace the pipes, the water pipes. The water pipes were disintegrating because of the soil, which was alkaline. And Japanese Americans very much resisted that labor for a variety of reasons. But one thing that I try to emphasize is that the environment itself, the alkaline soil, the conditions of the camp had created this problem to begin with. And so you can't sort of disentangle the importance of the environment to this particular labor dispute. The other one I talk about happened in Minidoka, where they wanted to reduce the number of maintenance workers who worked in the latrine, basically the washrooms, and they needed to have both janitors clean these areas, but also, especially during the winter, they needed boiler men to maintain the boilers for hot water. And so, again, I sort of emphasize that the labor dispute didn't emerge in the summer, when that was when maintaining the boilers so the pipes didn't freeze was a real issue. It became really an issue in the winter. And so here's where these like harsh seasonal changes affected the practice of labor resistance. And so the janitors and boilermen sort of realized that they had more leverage and they could fight back against this reduction in labor during the winter, when their labor was much more crucial, where if they didn't maintain the boilers, there was the possibility that no one would have hot water and that the pipes would freeze, and that would create enormous cost, you know, expense to the federal government if those pipes had to be replaced. So I think that's one example where we can see resistance, how environment and resistance sort of intertwined really explicitly. My other sort of kind of favorite example of this would have to do with outdoor recreation and sort of moments. And again, there's not sort of an organized resistance, but moments when Japanese Americans are essentially sneaking out of the camps, you know, undetected in most cases, to go fishing, to go hiking, to engage in recreational activities. So they're flaunting the WRA rules in order to really obtain some semblance of freedom, some sort of personal enjoyment from the natural surroundings. So that's another example where sort of environment and resistance intertwine.
Great. And a couple more questions. I mean, one is that, you know, one of the points that you made early in this podcast is that, you know, you wanted to complicate the narrative about oppressor and oppressee by focusing to a certain extent on the white American planners of these camps and the people who are managing them. And I was wondering if you would expand upon that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think there were, you know, I think it's, again, it's easy to sort of kind of suggest or to assert that, and some scholars have, that the WRA was this oppressive federal agency. And I think that is problematic. And I think, again, there were definitely WRA officials who really did have racist attitudes towards Japanese Americans and were, you know, treated them in a really paternalistic way. But I think there were other WRA officials who did really try their best to maintain or at least acknowledge the situation of Japanese Americans and to try to, you know, acknowledge their humanity to some extent. So, you know, one example comes to mind was one of the, and this comes up my epilogue, where there's, you know, this one story of a Japanese American boy who sort of, a couple examples of recreation where, you know, a WRA guard loaned him some fish, gave him some fishing gear, for instance, or where guards maybe turned a blind eye when people were trying to sneak out of camp to go pursue their recreational activities, for instance. So that's, you know, one example where perhaps the, you know, who knows what the motivations of the guards were, but they certainly didn't do what they were supposed to do, which was to make sure that no one left. Another example that comes to mind is one of the couple of the different agricultural, kind of the white agricultural heads at some of the camps, very much collaborated with Japanese American farmers and recognized that, that, you know, sort of took a couple of individuals under their wing and helped them and took advantage of their expertise, as at the same time trying to impart some of their knowledge on to them. So I think that's another example where we see WRA officials really, you know, not seeing themselves as, you know, sort of implementing this really oppressive program upon Japanese Americans, but seeing some level of collaboration. And I, you know, I hesitate to say that they were collaborating, because they weren't collaborating per se, but I think there was at least some effort among select individuals, some effort to at least work with Japanese Americans, even as they were sort of supervising them or, you know, telling them what they had to do and on some level. So I think that's sort of one way in which that becomes evident. But the other way is just the environment itself becomes kind of an actor in this story. So as much as federal officials wanted to, you know, grow a lot of food or build, make sure that they built the camps up by a particular time or make sure that they were properly, had proper roofing material. Sometimes the natural environment very much intervened with those, not intentionally, but there's ways in which the environment really stymied their efforts to establish these really, you know, finely, you know, well-oiled machines of camps. I mean, they just weren't. There were always problems that were cropping up that had to deal with. Leaking pipes, broken windows, you know, all sorts of problems that always came up. And I feel like many WRA officials were simply running from one crisis to the next crisis. And they weren't, you know, sitting in their offices overseeing this really, you know, oppressive regime. They were really just trying to keep things operating as best they could. So the environment itself sort of limited their ability to implement this really kind of stringent regime.
Yeah. And then you close the book, you know, the camps closed at the end of the war or shortly after the end of the war. And, you know, you close the book by kind of taking the story forward into the late 40s and the aftermath of this. And so what is the sort of environmental history of this, of the post, the post-incarceration Japanese American community?
Yeah, so I really focus just on the farmers or in some farmers. So there were some, and this was sort of a surprise in my research, some who actually decided that they didn't want to go back to the Pacific Coast, that they were going to farm in the arid West. So in Colorado, for instance, or Utah, they found that they could get land, they could start farming. Some of them saw this as sort of a stopgap measure because they weren't able to go back to the Pacific Coast, or at least they knew that they would have problems finding land as well as housing on the Pacific Coast. So they figured, okay, I can farm in Colorado for a couple of years, then I'll head back. But some saw it as a permanent, not a lot, but there were a few handfuls of farmers who decided to stay in the arid West permanently and make their fortune there. So, you know, they very much saw ways that perhaps, you know, they couldn't go back to the Pacific Coast and continue their environmental activities there, but they could still be farmers in other places. And so they pursued that. Most Japanese Americans who did try to go back to the Pacific Coast found it very difficult to reclaim land. This largely had to do with pre-existing or pre-war alien land laws that made it very difficult for most Japanese Americans to own their own farmland. So because most of their farmland had been leased, they couldn't necessarily find land when they returned. Those individuals who did own farmland and returned often found that it was in shambles, that even if they had caretakers, sometimes, you know, orchards had been neglected, so on and so forth. So it was very much an uphill battle to get those farms back up and running. Similarly with fishermen, they typically had liquidated their boats before the war. After the war, very difficult to get back into fishing. And at that point, the first generation, the Issei, many of them didn't want to. They were getting older in their years, and it was difficult to go get back into those industries. So they faced a number of different challenges trying to get back into agricultural in particular.
So I guess the last question to kind of build on that is, you know, we tell the story about Japanese incarceration as one of a kind of a national apology and a mistake. And yet, you know, right now we're in a moment in our history with the rise of xenophobia and the rise of white nationalism. And in the, you know, COVID era, this has taken on a starkly anti-Asian tone. And as a scholar of, you know, one of the most significant and horrifying examples of anti-Asian racism in American history, I was just wondering if you had any comments or thoughts about this moment that we're finding ourselves in right now.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think, you know, there have been numerous moments in the past decade or, you know, couple of decades at this point where the Japanese American incarceration has become the history of the Japanese American incarceration has become sort of back in the news, so to speak. So the first was after 9/11 and sort of racial profiling after 9/11 and how that very much harkened back to Japanese American incarceration. There have been other moments, but yeah, today now is another one. And I think what it simply emphasizes is this idea in Asian American history of this idea of the perpetual foreigner, the idea that no matter how many generations, no matter how American, a particular, in this case, Japanese American person or Asian American person might be, there's always this suspicion and always this perception that they aren't truly American, that they aren't fully American. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic has amplified that idea once again. So you see people of all different Asian ancestries, whether Chinese or Vietnamese or Japanese, being targets for this blanket anti-Asian racism. I think that's very much a reflection of the idea that all Asian Americans are foreigners, that they will never be fully accepted as Americans. They will always be seen as somewhat different, whether they're first generation immigrants or they are, you know, fourth generation Americans. I think the COVID-19 pandemic has really shown that once again. And it's shown that Asian Americans continually have to assert their Americanness, even when they shouldn't. So I think, you know, the one moment that received a lot of attention was when Andrew Yang wrote an editorial in the Washington Post, and he essentially encouraged Asian Americans to essentially be ultra patriotic, to really show their Americanness. And many Asian Americans really reacted negatively to that point because it, again, reinforces that idea that Asian Americans have to prove themselves when they shouldn't. You know, what many other white Americans aren't being asked to be ultra patriotic or to sort of prove that they're Americans. Why should Asian Americans be encouraged to do something similar or be encouraged to do that? So I think that that's what it sort of. Yeah, so that's my sort of quick response to how this story, you know, has come to pass again. And I think Japanese Americans faced that during the war, that both first generation, second generation, who had been completely loyal Americans, who had done everything to, you know, their actions and deeds showed a great deal of patriotism. Yet their loyalty to the United States was automatically questioned because of because they were of Japanese heritage, and so that's something similar happening today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Connie. Once again, we've been speaking with Connie Chang and about her book from 2018, "Nature Behind Barbed Wire: An Environmental History of Japanese American Incarceration." It's available from Oxford University Press. Thank you very much, Connie.
Thanks so much, Eric. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,